abide by Sharia laws, right?
Yeah.
And we also know that, you know, not everywhere can you find Muslims, right? There are some places which are very remote from other Muslim-dominated areas. So basically, we are, you know, sometimes finding a scarcity of foods, you know, based on the Sharia laws, right? Islamically speaking. So can Muslims suffice with kosher in this regard?
Well, there are some Muslims out there thinking that kosher must be halal because it comes from an animal that is slaughtered very much like in the way that Muslims slaughter the animals.
Mm-hmm.
So kosher is actually the meat of an animal, a halal animal,
mm-hmm.
That is slaughtered by a Jew. Okay.
Yes.
And reportedly, the Jews, in fact, slaughter the animals in the same way as we do.
But do they face it to Qibla?
No, that is not. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other problems as well, you know.
Right.
There are some Sunni sects or denominations saying that kosher is halal, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so they eat. But the Shia religious authorities say that kosher is absolutely forbidden.
Unanimously.
Unanimously, of course, because it lacks certain requirements
mm-hmm.
that must be fulfilled while slaughtering an animal.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most important requirements is the fact that the person who slaughters the animal is not a Muslim, okay? He is a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
He does not believe in the Prophet of Islam, and obviously he does not. And then the other condition that is also missing is that he does not recite takbir.
Mm-hmm.
And there is also a third condition which is not fulfilled, and that is that the animal is not slaughtered in the direction of Qibla. So these three main conditions are missing, and obviously a kosher cannot be halal. Now there are some Muslims and even some Shia Muslims who are living in a Sunni setting, saying that we can, for example, make the meat halal by just reciting takbir. Okay, the meat is there in the supermarket; it's on sale, and of course you can buy it.
Obviously, it's a dead. Yeah. Animals,
and
meat,
it,
right?
Yeah, it is a dead, and it comes from a dead animal. The animal has already been slaughtered by either mechanically
mm-hmm.
or maybe by hand, manually.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But some people are there who maintain that if you recite, let's say, Bismillah or Takbir or any, or utter God's name,
yes,
then the meat becomes halal.
Right.
And the number of those people who believe as such is not, unfortunately, few and far between. There are many, many Muslims who believe that, okay, that such meat sold on the market can be made halal by reciting Bismillah. But that's not correct. This is
right.
This idea may come from some Sunni minority group, okay? But we, the Shia Muslims, do not believe in such thing, okay?
I see.
The meat must be halal, and in order for a Muslim to consume halal meat, he should make sure that, first of all, the meat, the animal is slaughtered by a Muslim, and then all the
requirements should be met.
The requirements should be met. There are certain requirements, of course, which have been explained in the manual of Islamic laws, and all
right.
these requirements are essential, and
mm-hmm.
they must be fulfilled, otherwise the meat is not halal.
Okay, let's take a break, and we'll discuss and continue this topic after the break. Stay with us.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istiftah is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Back to the program, Islamic Law on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, and my guest is still Sheikh Javed in the studio. Sheikh Javed, you were talking about kosher and the status of, or jurisprudential status of kosher. Would you like to add anything?
Yeah. If you go to the West, to non-Muslim countries, of course, there are big stores, selling meat, and there is a tag on the meat, halal tag, okay?
Yes.
And this halal tag is everywhere. Halal meat is very expensive.
Yes.
It's not found everywhere, just as rightly mentioned, because of the paucity and the scarcity of halal meat. Halal meat is expensive. It's not available everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah.
So that's why some people add or write the tag, the halal tag, to the meat, so that they can sell the meat for higher prices.
Mm-hmm.
And so now many people think, okay, this meat must be halal because there's a tag, halal tag, on the meat, and so it can be consumed.
Right.
But is it really valid? The tag, does it suggest that the meat is really halal? No one knows, especially if the seller is non-Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he sells the meat either in a restaurant or in a store. Okay,
so what should a Muslim do?
Yeah.
Should a Muslim actually go about research?
So the religious authority says that the tag should not be taken for it should not be relied upon, because anybody can make use of the tag, halal tag, and sell his meat. Okay. The thing that a Muslim should do is that the first of all, he should make sure that the person who sells the meat is a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this
if
is very
not,
important. And if he is not a Muslim, then according to the a widely accepted principle of jurisprudence, that meat is automatically treated as non-halal, even if that meat is, the meat is said to be halal, but
yes.
Since the seller is a non-Muslim, you cannot trust that person. You cannot trust that person, and you cannot buy it. So the meat, basically, according to the principle of jurisprudence, is treated as non-halal,
mm-hmm.
unless there are indications or there are signs indicating that the meat is halal. For example, if that person is a Muslim,
mm-hmm.
and that Muslim is not a carefree person, someone who's reckless, who's not very much, who's not a practicing Muslim. So,
yes.
And there's a big difference between a practicing Muslim and non-practicing Muslim. If a Muslim is a practicing Muslim, he offers prayers, he actually gives his zakat and does.
Sheikh Javed, when I go to a supermarket, I can't really do a research about how practicing or whether the salesperson is a practicing Muslim or not. Isn't it too difficult and demanding?
For you, this criterion does not apply.
Mm-hmm.
This standard does not apply. So you as a guest, as someone who is new to a country,
yes.
cannot eat and consume meat. You should be careful. You should exercise precaution.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, unless the person is a reliable Muslim and he is, the face of that individual,
mm-hmm.
who is a Muslim, clearly suggests that he is a kind of practicing Muslim and a reliable person, then you can buy the meat and consume it. Otherwise, you cannot eat that meat.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javed, contributing to the program Islamic Law on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javed, signing off.
What is it you would be trying to do on climate change? What is it you would be trying to prevent if you were leading the United States at the conference?
Well, first of all, I think one of the dumbest statements I've ever heard in politics, in the history of politics as I know it, was Obama's statement that our number one problem is global warming, okay? When we have large groups of people that want to blow up every one of our cities, that want to destroy our country, that want to kill our people, and he's worried about global warming. I think it's one of the dumbest things I've ever seen.
Having two cars, three cars in your family and a television set in every room and living that sort of life that people live in developed countries and even in emerging economies now has a cost to it. The cost is climate change.
And the time is running out. Time is running out. We've got 10, as the scientists say, we have 10 years to reduce our emissions by 90%. You know, we've got to keep 80% of the fossil fuels in the ground. That's a massive shift in our ways of life.
It is going to affect the way we do everything. It is going to affect the way we transport ourselves. It's going to affect what we eat, when we eat. It's going to affect how we heat, cool our homes. It's going to affect how we build our homes. It's going to affect mostly, certainly how we produce our food. It's going to affect practically every human endeavor.
If we fail in Paris, then the whole world is looking at a globally catastrophic situation, which will not spare anybody. It will hit the rich countries. New York will be affected. Berlin will be affected. London will be affected. It will affect everybody.
The average temperature on Earth has already risen by 1 degree Celsius. If we exceed 2 degrees Celsius of warming, most ecosystems will collapse. To prevent this, the United Nations has been trying to reach a global climate agreement since 1995. My film team and I are going to Paris to meet the people who are deciding about our future.
Guardians of the Earth. Part 2.
At an airport shielded by the military, over 150 heads of state make their arrival. It's the largest diplomatic gathering in history. And it's called COP21. We nearly lost our permission to film due to tightening security after the terrorist attacks Paris had suffered some weeks before. But ultimately, the UN does allow us to be among the world's leaders with our crew. The negotiations open in the big red plenary hall.
Distinguished delegates, ladies and gentlemen, dear friends, Paris must be where the world unites as one. Paris must be where we show that we are capable of standing in solidarity with one another. Dear friends, never before has a responsibility so great been in the hands of so few.
20,000 negotiators from all nations get to work on formulating the agreement's text. They're closely watched by 10,000 NGO observers and journalists. top president, we want to know what the obstacles to a final agreement are.
I have no doubt that we're going to reach an agreement here next year. The next week! Woo! Next week! Okay. However, here's a concern that I hope that we all share. Is it going to be as transformative as we need? Because an agreement that only points toward gradual shifting of energy systems, of deforestation rates, of transportation, of everything else that contributes to climate change, only a gradual shift is not going to do it.
My name is Ronnie Jumo. I'm Seychelles' roving ambassador, or ambassador at large, for climate change and small island developing state issues. And in the absence of my president and the ministers, I'm the head of delegation for the Seychelles delegation to COP21.
In my youth, I actually did quite a bit of research and work in Samoa, and fell in love with a beautiful island which had the most beautiful singing I have ever heard. And that contrasts quite remarkably with the Samoa that I saw last year. A Samoa that is still a beautiful island, but that is in serious threat.
Night has fallen, and the COP venue is calm for the moment. Skepticism continues to grow, and the numbers make clear why. The current text still has 1,585 square brackets and issues to be resolved. There are 9 days left. In the main plenary hall, everybody keeps talking about ambition. But especially in the case of Australia, such words can serve to disguise a negotiating team's actual motives.
Together, we have generated a text that holds within it the opportunity to conclude an ambitious and credible Paris Agreement that can establish a strategy to keep global temperature rise below 2 degrees. Let us be clear, we need ambition and clarity here and now.
My name is Peter Woodcott, and I'm the Australian Ambassador for the Environment. We have a team of something like 30 negotiators here. And we are a major mining nation. We've always been a major exporter of coal. I think we're the second largest exporter of coal in the world. If we were to stop exporting coal in Australia, that would not make, in our view, any difference to the state of emissions in the world. It may even exacerbate them because Australian coal is high quality. And our Prime Minister has said, if we stopped exporting coal, it doesn't mean coal isn't going to be used. Coal is still used extensively in, particularly in our part of the world and in Africa. Still, coal remains the cheapest, in those parts of the world, the cheapest source of energy and power, and that means the fastest way towards economic development and growth for them. So coal is, again, it's a very complex issue. You can't be too simplistic about coal.
Up to now, hundreds of security officers have managed to successfully monitor the 2-kilometer-wide area for threats. But suddenly, some of them start looking very nervous.
Last night, Australia's Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, spoke at a side event hosted by Indonesia, where she said coal will remain critical to promoting prosperity, growing economies, and alleviating hunger for years to come. You're welcome, poor people. Here you go, have some coal. Hand out some coal to these poor people. Yes, delicious coal. Yummy, delicious coal. Oh, man. Oh, eat it. Eat that coal. Yet the Australian government still supports the construction of the largest coal mine in the southern hemisphere, right on the edge of the Great Barrier Reef. In Australia, we love big things.
Salim tells us that behind closed doors, the small island states are fighting for the survival of their nations. There are about 30 countries that will cease to exist if we don't reach the 1.5 degree temperature target. The press and the public are barred from entering this meeting. but we managed to sneak into the secret talks with a hidden camera.
On 1.5, for small island states, holding the increase in temperature rise to below 1.5 degrees is a matter of survival, as it is for so many countries in this room. Mr. President, would it have been better for all of us, for future generations, to have text that expresses the urgency of actions to hold temperature rise to below 1.5 degrees? Absolutely.
We wish we can be as optimistic as our co-chairs who were heading the ambition group. I really think we need to have much more discussions with regard to Article 2, Paragraph 1A. I don't think we really do have consensus there. Or in Article 3.1, we are really far away from consensus, Mr. President, and I think we really need to have much more discussions.
We small island developing states, we see it every day. Some of us, we are so small that we hear the wind blow from the east across to the west. Some of us are so small that when rain comes, we get frightened and we anticipate that danger could lie ahead for us. The day-to-day evidence of ordinary citizens that live in small island developing states cannot be denied. The fact is, sir, that we know, because we watch our beaches disappear, we watch our homes washed away, we watch our dreams washed away, and we certainly do not want to watch our lives washed away.
The dramatic pleas of the island states are shocking to us. Within the next 10 to 20 years, the first of them will already have disappeared.
While we have been here, we have seen a repeat of the pattern of more floods and landslides. Indeed, today in Chennai, these events continue. This video was taken from just a few days ago, and the people of Tamil Nadu are suffering the consequences of this continuing downpour. Today, England has experienced the largest downpour in the entire history. Many people had to be rescued there. These events, may I reiterate, are taking place while we are here. Every day in the world, these events are occurring in places all around the earth. Super Typhoon Haiyan was the strongest ocean-based storm at its time to ever make landfall. And of course, our hearts went out to the people of Tacloban.
Haiyan that year was the 21st typhoon to hit Philippines. They got the warnings, they went to the shelters, they died in the shelters collapsed. So Haiyan was not a normal typhoon, it was a super typhoon. Haiyan hit the Philippines the day before the Warsaw COP, and Liep Sano, the chief Philippines negotiator, made a statement, a very emotional statement.
I see Philippines asking for the floor, so please.
The initial assessment showed that Haiyan left a wake of massive destruction that is unprecedented, unthinkable. Mr. President, I speak for my delegation, but I speak for the countless people who will no longer be able to speak for themselves. Now, Mr. President, if you will allow me, Super Typhoon Haiyan made landfall in my own family's hometown. And the devastation is staggering. I struggle to find words even for the images that we see on the news coverage. And I struggle to find words to describe how I feel about the losses. In solidarity with my countrymen who are struggling to find food back home, I will now commence a voluntary fasting for the climate. This means I will voluntarily refrain from eating food during this COP until a meaningful outcome is in sight. Mr. President, what my country is going through is madness. Mr. President, we can stop this madness right here in Warsaw.
That he's going on a fast. He's going to not eat for the next 2 weeks. Many of us fasted with him. That's how we got the Warsaw International Mechanism in the COP. You know, for 19 years, the rich countries prevented us from talking about loss and damage. But we managed to get it done because we were united till the very end. We said we will not agree to anything in Warsaw. We go home, Warsaw is a failure, unless you give us this. And in the end, they blinked. They gave it to us. It's the only time we've got something out of them.
Outside the COP venue, we're lucky to run into Yeb Sanyo, the former lead negotiator of the Philippines at the COP in Warsaw.
After Warsaw, without me knowing the full reason behind it, I was taken out of the Philippine delegation. So it's not as if I walked away from the process. I was taken out. And if I was taken out because I have been vocal about rich nations having to take responsibility and about the fossil fuel industry being the biggest problem that stands in the way, that should give me a lot of pride to be taken out. Because climate change is a battle that will not be won or lost in the conference halls here.
As the powerful groups in the negotiations work to undermine the 1.5 degree goal of the poor and vulnerable countries, Salim is fighting behind the scenes for his allies. In this, he has some influential backers.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm here in my capacity as the chair of the Independent Expert Advisory Group to the Climate Vulnerable Forum. It's now my pleasure to invite Christiana Figueres, the Executive Secretary of the UN Framework Convention. Christiana.
Thank you very much, my good friend Salimo, and Honorable President Aquino, distinguished ministers. May I raise a voice of concern? I do not see the countries working in an articulated and coordinated fashion for this Paris Agreement. This is an urgent matter, but it is the countries around this table and many others outside that are going to determine whether we have an ambitious agreement or whether we just have an agreement. The danger is not to aim too high and fail. The danger is to aim too low and only do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Christiana.
It was agreed that all countries would now take action. And so the idea of the INDC, the intended nationally determined contributions, came up. And every country started developing their own. The problem with this voluntary action is that when you add it up, it's not enough. Collectively, it doesn't take us to 2 degrees, it takes us to maybe just under 3 degrees. And so if we want to go to 1.5 degrees, then we have to ramp it up. Every country has to do much more than they promised.
The national contributions don't even come close to saving us from environmental collapse.
Now, Your Excellency, the goal has to be durable. Making specific references, which we have on the table now, options for specific numbers, may not make it a durable agreement. Any goal that threatens our ability to eradicate poverty, any goal that threatens our ability to secure food, is not going to be accepted. And there are one of the options, at least here, that option can be a threat to sustainable development, poverty eradication, and food reduction.
Mr. President, the draft agreement text is shorter, but we need a bolder text with fewer undecided options, including on key issues. Mr. President, while the basis for an ambitious landing zone is still in this text, many options cross our red lines. Some options have even been lost altogether. We must raise the level of ambition. Thank you very much.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned.
مقایسه گاهی سعودی است، گاهی نزولی است و گاهی همسد.
Dear brothers and sisters, we have three types of comparison. They are called ascending, descending, and parallel. Now, ascending comparison in financial matters might cause anxiety and unrest for a person, whereas in descending comparison can cause internal peace for someone. As it is related by Salman al-Farsi, who narrated from Prophet Muhammad, stating, O Salman, try to have a descending comparison in your worldly affairs. This statement by Prophet Muhammad means that we never compare our financial affairs with people who are higher than us, because we might not be able to reach them and become anxious and sometimes jealous inside.
Surah Qasas, ayah 79. خوب دقت کنید.
In Surah Qasas, ayah 79, we read, So he emerged before his people in his finery. Those who desired the life of the world said, We wish we had like what Korah has been given. Indeed, he is greatly fortunate. Based on this ayah, the lovers of this world made an ascending comparison between themselves and Korah and wished to be as fortunate as Korah was in terms of wealth. This is why they felt unfortunate about themselves, since the comparison was based on worldly desires. Therefore, comparing oneself with a person who is richer and wealthier than you only causes unrest inside your soul. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a shorter speech by Hojatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com/Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. Imam Ali alayhi salam has spoken many beautiful sermons that have got deep and powerful messages, and in the sermon number 3 that we are discussing presently is where he has presented the reason behind his governance when he took over the governance and the caliphate from the others that did not deserve, and he who really deserved it from the very beginning had to take it afterwards. But anyhow, that is a deep discussion theologically and also historically. What is important is that Imam Ali alayhi salam here explains the reason behind his leadership, and he elaborates an important point, and that is that now that he's taking this authority, he sees that the same problem that existed at the time of the Prophet has now come back to this community 25 years after the death of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, we had discussed that this problem is actually the problem of polytheism. But this polytheism is not the form of polytheism that we know normally, that we understand, in our normal, understandings. Rather, a different form of polytheism. Normally, when we hear polytheism, we feel like someone who believes in 5 or 6 gods, or maybe 100 gods, or one who believes in a partner to God and things like that. Rather, polytheism in Islam is much deeper. It also includes obeying another entity apart from God without that other entity having permission from God to be an object of obedience. This is also a form of polytheism, because obedience is the sole right of God and God alone. And to obey other than God without permission, without being granted that authority, is definitely another form of polytheism. And Imam Ali alayhi salam says that polytheism has returned. Now, when we say that this polytheism is returned, maybe we should look at some of the examples that occurred at the time of Imam Ali alayhi salam, that era, to see what was this polytheism that had come back. We see that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says very clearly in the Quran that he is yaf'alu ma yasha'. Allah is the one who does whatever he pleases. Wa yahkumu ma yurid, and he gives the command or makes a verdict regarding however he wishes, like whatever he wishes, he gives a verdict for that. يَحْكُمُ مَا يُرِيدُ. Allah is like that. But we notice at that time there were entities from before the time of Imam Ali alayhi salam, before Imam Ali alayhi salam came to be a caliph, and even during that time, we see that unfortunately this role was usurped by certain human beings. There are people before Imam Ali alayhi salam who are ready to put the law of God under their feet to achieve their objectives. It is there in the history of Islam. There are people, there are known individuals that, for instance, that accepted not to punish a person who committed adultery to another woman who was forcefully, her husband was killed, and then that woman was taken, and that woman was performed adultery upon, and then after that the culprit was not punished, and therefore the word of God was not established in that sense.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
And there are many other examples. Now, when we come to the examples of the type of usurpation of this right of God to be able to perform whatever he pleases, to rule and govern however he wishes, was taken by others. There were individuals who, for example, Muawiyah, we have that he would do whatever he wishes. He would kill people. Okay, he would, usurp their rights under the name of God, that he is the one who, for example, is applying the word of God. But in reality, it was his own rule. It was his own whims that he was applying in the society. And that's why at that time, if you asked people, is Muawiyah God? They would say, no, he's not God. And he's a slave of God, of course. But yet, when you look at the way he was running the community and the society, and you would see that, of course, there was he actually acted like a person who would just command without knowing the law of God. A person who, for example, leads the Friday prayer and the sermon on a Wednesday. The same person who killed very sacred people like Hujr bin Adi without proper sanction. The same person who permitted, who called Ziyad bin Abi. Ziyad was a person who was the result of adultery. And they didn't know his father, so they would say Ziyad bin Abi, Ziyad the son of his father. His mother's name was Sumayya, Ziyad bin Sumayya. Muawiyah openly came and said that this is my brother. Why? Because he brought someone to prove that his father was actually performed adultery with his mother, and therefore this child was born. While in Islam, a person who is born out of adultery is counted as fatherless. He just has a mother. That is the law of Islam. That is the law. But he put down this law and broke the law and brought his own law. So we notice that at that time, this polytheism where a person had the audacity to come and present their own feelings, their own desires, their own whims as laws of Islam was unfortunately a common problem. And therefore, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that this polytheism has come back. And yes, it had come in a dreadful manner back into the society. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في وفي المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Turtles get a second chance to spread their fins after being found with bellies full of plastic. They were rescued and are now being released back to the sea in Argentina. Two green turtles and four loggerhead turtles were saved from fishing nets in Buenos Aires province. The group was taken to Grupo Marino Foundation, where they recuperated after purging 10 types of plastic from their bodies. Rehabilitation of the turtles lasted over a month and included blood tests and other procedures to make sure they were free of plastic. A biologist with the foundation says the danger of plastic is that it's silent, and usually its dangers are so gradual that it goes unnoticed.
Many times the animal appears to be in perfect health. However, during the checkup and evaluation, we found a large amount of this material inside. So it is important to get rid of the plastic before the condition worsens and it ends up causing the deaths of the specimens.
The turtles had mistakenly eaten plastic, thinking it was food. Wind, waves, and sunshine break down discarded plastic into tiny pieces, which litter ocean waters. Much of this plastic waste can be found on beds of seaweed that turtles forage for food. This trash ends up fatally clogging their bellies, causing the decline in the population of this graceful reptile. The Indian-administered Kashmir has the world's only floating post office. A 200-year-old houseboat on a famous Dal Lake in Srinagar, set up during the British rule in India, the post office has survived throughout the years because of its charm. Our correspondent Shahanabath has more.
The Indian-administered Kashmir was once a princely independent state, out of bounds for outsiders. As the ruler of Jammu and Kashmir disallowed non-locals to own property in this picturesque region. During the British rule in the Indian subcontinent, many Britons tried to find an alternative way of living in Kashmir. Thus, houseboat on the world-famous Dal Lake came into existence. Today, the lake is a home to hundreds of such boats, which are a major attraction for tourists around the globe. This one is a unique boat, the only floating post office in the whole world. This is a 200-year-old boat built by the British. It has truly stood the test of time, as it still functions.
Post office, Dal Lake.
This is not an ordinary post office. We're standing on a heritage property. I've enjoyed my work since the very first day I came here. It's a unique experience to be working here. And every day, I get the chance to meet people from different corners of the world.
The boat is not limited to postal services. It also has a small museum where colorful stamps from the 1980s are put to display, along with a collection of rare philately stamps. The post office is a hot tourist destination in the region. Locals also come to this post office to send postcards to their loved ones, inviting them to visit Kashmir.
Floating post office.
In the age of technology, electronic mails, e-cards and other internet applications have made it extremely easy for people to communicate. But sending a postcard from this floating post office gives one a really different feeling.
The floating post office underwent reconstruction in 2011 and is currently a part of the Indian postal system. Recently, the office started offering banking services, thus attracting more locals.
I have opened an account here for my daughter. It's hassle-free and this place suits my mind. It's not like the usual offices. Visiting this place with kids is like a trip.
Yet another attraction of this post office is this souvenir shop, from where everyone can buy postcards, stamps, traditional crafts and greeting cards.
This floating post office in Kashmir's Dal Lake is like a time machine. It brings people back to 2 centuries ago and shows them the history of the beautiful region. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Now let's go to Germany to hear the heartwarming story of how technology is turning a young boy's life around. 7-year-old Joshua has a severe lung disease which has made him unable to go to school. But now he can attend his classes from home with the help of an avatar robot. The device sits in Joshua's Berlin classroom, enabling him to listen to the classroom in real time to what his teacher and classmates are saying. Joshua can even interact with everyone else by making the robot display a blinking signal.
Each year, a village in Vietnam becomes awash in red and orange as it gears up for the Lunar New Year with spectacular mass production of incense. January is usually the busiest time when villagers are dyeing, drying and whittling bamboo bark to make the fragrance sticks. Also, the scent of each batch is carefully tailored to suit the tastes of the regions where they will be sold. Most households here are involved in this ancient trade and sales are a major part of their livelihoods. The Lunar New Year will begin on the first day of February. Around this time, sales tick up with throngs of people crowding into temples to light incense during worship. A 3-year-old girl from China's Hebei province has astonished ski enthusiasts with her impressive snowboarding talent.
Hello everybody, I'm Wang Shishi. I'm 3 years old and I can snowboard now.
Shishi's skills have attracted a lot of attention as a toddler boldly tackles the slopes. She makes snowboarding look easy. Despite her tender age, she is already taming the slopes at a higher skill level than a number of other aspiring snowboarders. Her parents say she has been practicing for less than 2 weeks and her progress is startling.
I remember several years ago, I felt quite scared when I was on the advanced slope, but a mother told me that Shishi started to snowboard down right when she got to the advanced trail. She was not afraid at all.
Her parents say she quickly grasped the snowboarding movements and techniques, including some of the trickier swivels and turns. They say Shishi is enjoying the progress she is making on the slopes, and every chance she gets, she asks to go snowboarding. The young snowboarder's mum says the hobby has also brought the family closer together as they enjoy a shared passion together.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The chronic shortage of human organs has always been an issue for patients, especially those suffering from heart diseases. But now a major scientific breakthrough is in the making. U.S. surgeons have successfully implanted a heart from a genetically modified pig into a man. Doctors had said the patient, 57-year-old, was unable to have human transplant because of his health conditions. But now he is recovering from his latest surgery. The surgeons say the man is being carefully monitored to determine how the new organ is performing. But for those who want to know why pigs, here is why. Pigs are considered ideal donors because of their size and rapid growth, among other things.
You know, it is a game changer because, now
we will have these organs readily available. If this works, and you know, and I hope it will work, we'll have these organs available. We have the technique of genetically modifying. So if there are more tweaking required for modifying the genes, we will be able to do that.